Everyone who meets me, who doesn't know me, has a projection of what I am.
It's not even their fault.
No, and listen, we were all probably guilty of that a wee bit, like with people we meet.
I did the same thing with Hervé when I met him.
Of course,
I've projected onto him the ha-ha
and it's something
joke.
We could all work on trying to not do. But I think for me, from the other side of it, I guess, is that like you're fucked the moment you live up to the projection. That's when you're fucked.
But can I say what's really interesting is this whole film is about being judged. One of the themes is how we all prejudge and rush to judgment. You know, in a way, what I love about Peter and Jamie in the film is the audience will bring their preconceptions about whatever they think. And you're talking about two people who have, for large parts of their life probably, been judged on their looks. But, you know, it's superficial.
That's Jamie Dornan and Sasha Gervasi, this week on the Rich Roll Podcast. The Rich Roll Podcast. Hey, everybody, what's happening? How's it going? How are you doing? What is the latest? Very grateful to spend an hour or so with you here today. My name is Rich Roll. This is my podcast, and I am your dutiful cruise director on the Lido deck on this journey of self-betterment and self-actualization that we are all blazing here together. Welcome. Today, very excited to sit down with one of my very best friends, somebody I love dearly and have known for over 20 years, writer, director, bon vivant, Sasha Gervasi, for his second appearance on the show, his first being episode 249 about 2 years ago. Sasha's credits include penning The Terminal, a little movie you might have seen directed by Steven Spielberg and starring Tom Hanks. Sasha also directed Hitchcock, starring Anthony Hopkins, but he is perhaps best known for a documentary called Anvil, The Story of Anvil, his Emmy and Independent Spirit Award-winning real-life Spinal Tap rockumentary about this also-ran Canadian heavy metal band that many critics consider one of the greatest films ever made about rock and roll. If you have not yet seen this documentary, I implore you to do so immediately. It is just fantastic. But the focus of today's conversation is Sasha's new movie. It's called My Dinner with Hervé. It premieres on HBO on October 20th. And it's a look at the wild, crazy life of French actor Hervé Villechaize, who, if you're my age, you will recall famously played a character called Tattoo in the number one hit 1970s TV series Fantasy Island. The film is based upon this crazy, insane night that Sasha had with Hervé, who was played in the movie by Game of Thrones Peter Dinklage, that transpired about a week before Hervé's suicide. And it's about this unlikely friendship that develops between these two guys that permanently changes both of their lives. It's a movie that Sasha began writing over 20 years ago when he was still a young buck in film school. It's the first script he ever wrote. And the movie is beautiful. It's funny. It's tragic. It's surprisingly emotional. I think it's the best work that Sasha has ever done. I think it's the best work that Peter Dinklage has ever done. And I do believe it is the best work that Jamie Dornan has ever done. He delivers this amazing, nuanced performance as Danny Tate, who is the journalist that's loosely based on Sasha's life. Jamie is, of course, most recognized for his portrayal as Christian Grey in the 50 Shades movies. But listen, if that's all you know about this guy, I got to tell you, there is way more to this man. He is an amazing talent. And just somebody with a lot more depth than you may imagine. I first came across him, it's got to be 4 or 5 years ago at this point, by way of a TV series that he did called The Fall, which you should all check out. It's this dark psychological thriller in which he co-stars with Gillian Anderson. And I was really struck by his very convincing ability to create depth, to evoke pathos and empathy for this seemingly irredeemable character that he plays. And I really believe that Hervé is going to be a game changer for him. It's a role that's going to leave audiences with a brand new appreciation for this guy's talents. Super excited to have both of these fine gentlemen on the show today. And there's a bunch more I want to say about them and this incredible movie before we dive into the conversation. But first, Let's take care of a little business, shall we? Okay. Thanks for sticking with me, you guys. I love my sponsors. They make this show possible. So one of the best ways to support the podcast beyond subscribing to it and sharing it with your friends is to patronize our partners. So thank you for that. So I first read a version of the Hervé script back in maybe 2005. And I knew immediately it was super special. As much autobiographical for Sasha, who was a bit of a mess when he was sent to interview Hervé, as it is universal. The movie and this conversation is about how a chance encounter between two people in various states of desperation develop this unlikely friendship that really forever alters both of their lives, for better and for worse. But more than that, it's about not giving up on a dream. It's about how we prejudge people based on their outsides. It's about the delusion of fame and this need to be seen. And ultimately, it's about what happens when we look outside ourselves for validation to solve the pain of life. This one is really fun. Both these guys are hilarious and super insightful. And I think you're going to really enjoy it. And the movie, which again premieres on HBO October 20th. So with that, I give you Jamie Dornan and Sasha Gervasi.
And I got to take some silent food with me.
You just can just munch away.
This is what we should be fucking recording.
I'm just going to lick this until it's finished.
Wait, why don't you start with that? Okay, are we ready? Push fucking record, dude.
It's fucking recording.
I'm silently going to lick the pickle until it's done with.
I just want to lick this until it's finished.
Podcast
lick Jamie
over.
Fucking door.
We're
lick
done. The pickle? I think we did
Is
it.
Is that it? We did it?
Isn't yeah. lick the pickle quite a satisfying thing to say?
I mean, you're fucking pickle. From Ireland.
I might start my own podcast called Lick the Pickle. You've got some in your teeth.
I do.
Oh, yeah. Sure. Can we I thought swear? You were going to tell him when he has shit on his face.
You sort of set the tone for right. him being polite, so I went for that.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for... slating some time for me in between Ellen and Ryan Seacrest. I'm quite touched.
You're a priority over
You are a priority. You're a top media outlet.
I'm excited We're to lucky. Talk to you guys. I just watched a movie like half an hour ago.
And
I was quite moved. I was moved by the movie itself and the narrative. I was touched by it. But I think that I was also very touched by it simply because I've known you, Sasha, for so long, and I've known this story for so long. And I read your original short script version of this that you wrote when you were in film school, I know how many years you've been working on this
story.
I
probably wrote it 20 years ago, I think, the first
I think
short script.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's got to be an emotional moment for you.
Definitely. It really is. It's a kind of bizarre sort of out-of-body experience because it's taken so long to get here. And then, you know, like, for example, just today to be running around with Jamie and just promoting it and having people responding emotionally to the film is incredible.
Well, these things happen when they're supposed to happen.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting that you know, Hervé was 50 mm-hmm. when this all went down, and now you're 51, right? Like you're at the age that he was at. So there's something kind of poetic about that.
But most importantly, Peter as well, because we tried to make the film 15 years ago, and we couldn't get it made.
He was too young, Pete.
Yeah, he was too. He really didn't.
He was
have, seriously though, he didn't have.
And just
right.
like there was only one guy who could play Tattoo. There's only one guy that could play Tattoo in the movie.
That's right.
You know.
That's right. You know, and so it was just not its time. And we had so many, you know, frustrating times and people who nearly wanted to make it and then didn't. And then we had offers that were just useless. And I think I said this earlier. I was talking with Jamie about it, but I cannot tell you how many times people said, dude, this is the most seriously uncommercial concept in the world. It's a suicidal dwarf film set in multiple time periods. Set in multiple time periods. It's incredibly expensive. It is literally, you could not come up with anything more completely uncommercial. And people said, just give it up. And I was like, I just couldn't do it.
Right.
But, you know.
What is the elevator pitch? I mean, what was the one-liner?
I don't even know if there was one.
How can you even?
You can't even pitch this as one line. But, you know, it was just a true life encounter with Hervé Villechaize in the final week of his life. And the film is basically that. It's this unexpected meeting between two people who at first could not be more dramatically different or seem more completely dissimilar, but who, as the narrative progresses and the layers are peeled away, become almost the same person.
Yeah, as the night progresses, it's almost like this odd couple. You feel like these guys have been having this argument for 20 years.
What I mean?
You're like, wait, they just met like 5 hours ago.
What? What? That's it? No more questions?
I've got more than enough. Actually, I have another interview to get to tonight.
Another interview tonight?
Unfortunately, yeah. I'm already late.
You know, I haven't given an interview in 10 years, but when your paper called, it has quite a reputation, you know?
Yeah, it does.
Which is why I'm so surprised.
Were you surprised?
They didn't used to send the juniors.
I'm not a junior.
Oh, only a junior would have written the story before he got here. Knick-knack. Tattoo. Just a silly little moment, but I'm sure that's all someone of your stature would be interested in.
That's funny. But you know you should be very careful. In a few years, I'm going to be editing that paper.
No, you won't.
But there was this intuitive sort of understanding and recognition of the other, even though they really didn't really like each other. I think they were both in a similar place, these two characters, at that time. And Hervé, obviously, in the final week of his life, and the Danny Tate character wrestling with the same issues Hervé is in a certain way. The difference, obviously, is I think there's hope and a future for one character, and the other's very much at the end of the road. And I think it's interesting because when I met Hervé for real and he was drinking and popping these pills, I mean, he had that green Samsonite vanity case filled with all these different medications marked with like strong, do not take at night, and extra strength. And, you know, it was just this sort of walking pharmacy and knives and guns. And it was just so bizarre. You know, he was obviously going down. And I think that when characters are going down, you know, they do one of two things. They either take someone with them or they rescue them. And I think throughout the main body of the film, Hervé is wrestling with toying with this guy, like, fuck life, fuck everything, I'm going out, I'm going to take this guy down too, just almost for, you know, evil fun almost. Mm-hmm. And what happens is through Danny Tate's forcibly kind of basically making Hervé face the truth of his own kind of responsibility in his downfall, in one sense, you know, Hervé, I think, gains a kind of respect for him because he really senses that this guy also has everything to win or lose from this encounter. He knows he's fucked up this other interview. He knows that the stakes are pretty high for him. And through this, ultimately, this incredible conflict, I think, you know, if the film works, a kind of friendship emerges and these two people realize they're kind of ships in the night. You know, one lives, one doesn't. But the point is that what started as a kind of, I'm going to take this guy down with me, becomes an unintended rescue story that through Hervé's kind of own experience, Tate is able to recognize that the path he's on is one that's not going to end well. And he really changes his life at the end of the film. And that is pretty much true to really what happened in real life too, was what I got from Hervé, which is why here we are 25 years later. I think if there wasn't something profound and real about it, I would never have persisted for this long and roped all these incredible talents into, you know, helping me to tell the story.
You're basically a lunatic.
I'm a complete lunatic. Right. Yeah, I mean, you have to be.
You have to be, of course.
I think, you know, like Anvil, you know, it's just this story of people who refuse to give up no matter what, you know, even when it is ridiculous and any normal person would quit.
Right. So this is in some respects a parallel track to Anvil and you're not giving up on this script. I mean, you wrote the first draft 20 years ago, But it's not like you put it away and picked it back up. I mean, we were in Italy in, what, 2005
or something like that? And I was rewriting
it then,
yeah.
And you were rewriting it then, and that was 13 years ago.
Well, I was making other films, and I was kept coming back to it. It was constantly evolving because I was dissatisfied with the script because I just felt it didn't really bring you into the feelings of the actual experience, and I wanted to try and somehow do that. So it was one of these labors of love. You know, it's like you need the story to kind of marinate in order for it to distill. It sometimes takes a long period of time. And so in this one, it took an incredibly long period of time. I was always just on the cusp but never getting it. And finally, you know, I decided to pick it up again about 3 years ago, having left it for about 5 years, you know, properly. And me and Pete, I sort of rewrote the script, and Pete really liked it, and we were really excited to make the film. And then again, it didn't happen. You know, got the same comments, the suicidal dwarf thing, you know, blah, 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 you know. And so we were really willing to let it go. We just said, you know, fuck it, it's never going to happen. You know, if we can't do it right, let's just accept our fate and just let it go. You know, it was a thing that could have happened. And then it's funny.
That's
in
very
life,
un-Anvil, though.
It's very un-Anvil. But we had no choice because, you know, with Anvil, what was easy was I was able to control that because I was paying for the movie myself. So, you know, it was a documentary, even though I shot it over 2 years. But with this, it was like we needed a lot of money. You know, we needed to be able to afford, you know, the best people. And as I said, it was a very ambitious schedule, and you know, it covers a lot of worlds and time frames. So,
well, you mentioned the character Danny Tate, which Jamie plays, which is more than semi-autobiographical. I mean, it's not you per se, but it's certainly your story and your experience with this character. Like, where do you, you know, first of all, Jamie, like, how did you approach playing this version of Sasha, and where does reality in your experience depart from the fictionalized version that Jamie portrays?
I mean, I think, you know, the word to take from that is like a version of, you know, like I think we agreed quite early on that there'd be a separation between the reality of what happened and what Sasha experienced with Hervé and what we portrayed on screen. Now, listen, obviously there's a lot of stuff that's very similar and some stuff that's exact, but the first time I read the script, he was scripted as Danny Tate, although I'd been filled in by my agent about the real story and that it was really Sasha who was the journalist all those years ago. And but I sort of, in a way, although at times it was difficult, but in a way I always felt that I was doing my own thing. And it was, I sort of needed to mimic
Sasha's behavior.
Well, yeah, well, geez, good luck.
Good luck on that one.
Who wants to see that anyway?
Good luck. I don't have the energy to do that, quite frankly.
Very bad idea.
No, I mean, but also, you know, it would be, it would have been a very different experience had I been being directed by the man I'm trying to portray and trying to capture his characteristics and his voice and his... I just think it would have taken away from something that was more sort of grounded in what we wanted it to be and feeling like it was within myself. And I speak for Pete as well in a way, because in a way he didn't want to mimic Hervé. He wanted to get the voice pretty close, but it still wanted to be his own version of. And in terms of how he looked and where we went with, you know, there, I think at one time down years before I was involved, you played around with prosthetics and stuff to make him look more like Hervé, and actually it ended up becoming a bit...
It was like just fake, you know? And at a certain point, just like Jamie's absolutely right, you know, Peter is playing his version of Hervé, and Danny Tate, yes, the basic core facts, you know, young journalist, final week alive with Hervé, interviews Hervé, and then is left with his story. I mean, those things are true, but, you know, in order for the film to work, Danny Tate had to become a fully fleshed out, a character that was fully alive, and Jamie had to take ownership of that character. I mean, as much as you're playing a version of me, I think it's fair to say, you know, you've had, I'm sure, things in your life, we don't want to get into too much detail, but there are moments where we've all been through things that, you know, Danny goes through. And so he was bringing as much of himself to it as possible. And I think that, you know, it was wonderful for there to be no pressure on either of us, because I wasn't looking for him to do anything specific other than to be hopefully emotionally authentic and to really dive into the role.
Yeah.
And he did. And Peter, similarly, you know, we knew that Peter Dinklage really doesn't look anything like Hervé, and he doesn't really sound anything like Hervé. So But the essence, the spirit, is so close to the real Hervé that Kathy, his real-life girlfriend, who lived with him for the last four years of his life and who sadly was there the night that, you know, Hervé killed himself, she saw the film the other day and she just was speechless because she felt, she said to, you know, me and Jessica, who produced the movie, she said, thank you for giving him back to me. It was really intense. So I think whatever Peter captured, it was close to the spirit. And similarly with Jamie, you know, he caught something authentic that I think is not just a really about me or even about him, but it's about a character who's on the edge, who's literally, as much as Hervé's stakes are life and death, it's life and death for Danny's career. It's life and death for Danny's soul. You know, if he's not able to face the wreckage he's caused through, you know, his incredibly destructive alcoholic behavior. And so the story is as much about those things as it is about the specifics of, you know, Hervé and my story. I mean, those are really the backdrop.
Right. It's in confronting Hervé with the truth of his life and his behavior that he's able to finally grapple with and come to terms with the truth of his own wreckage and situation to come to this place of acceptance, really. Because that's what the movie's about. I mean, the most impactful line in the whole movie for me and what I think is really at the core of the whole thing is when Hervé says, when Peter says, life depends not on what a man can do, but what he can accept, right? And that kind of is like, that's the thematic through line.
I think there are several things going on. That's part of it. And I think for both characters, the theme is almost the same. You've got two people, as I say, who present so dramatically differently, but ultimately who are both really facing the same thing. They're both struggling to find the courage to own their own truth, to recognize their part in things. And that's really why I think the film is, you know, resonating with the people who've seen it so far is, you know, we all walk into situations and we prejudge, as I did with Hervé. I walked into my first interview with Hervé and I thought, oh, this is going to be funny. This will be a laugh. You know, the plane, ha ha, get a few stories. And then, you know, when I was packing my stuff away, he walked around the table and he was pointing his lock knife that he'd been using to eat his duck à l'orange, you know, at my throat. You know, he was 2 feet from me and he had this look in his eye and he was like, I've told you all the bullshit stories. Now do you want to hear the real story of my life? And there was just something that punctured basically my own stupidity, my own prejudgment, because it was impossible for me to perceive or conceive that this surreal Fellini-esque creature was an actual human being. He was just a punchline to me. That's how the world saw him. And so he was able to kind of get my attention and bring me into the world. And I hope that the film in some way reflects that, because when Danny shows up at that restaurant, he could not be less interested in this kind of stupid little interview. He's got bigger fish to fry. And that was really what it was, how we all do that. You know, we think that, you know, we know what's up, and how often, you know, our judgment is just a wall between two human beings. And often we're so wrong because we don't know the whole truth or even part of it sometimes. And with Hervé, his story was so complex and different and painful and joyous and insane that, you know, it was just too much to really take in. Because so it's just put him in a pigeonhole of punchline, ha ha, funny tattoo. But, you know,
he also was somebody who imprinted on our young brains. I mean, Jamie's too young, but for you and I, we're the same age.
Are you saying we're old?
Yeah, we are old,
okay,
dude.
Okay, whatever.
Yeah. You're saying I'm young?
Yeah, how old is he? Like, he fucking looks 14.
It's all fucking relative,
it's this
dude.
Cream that he's been using. Honestly, it's like the special vegan cream.
Let's talk
cream
about your workout from the Himalayas. Can we talk about your workout routine?
Can we please, yeah.
Your latest modeling campaign?
We're on the fucking Hitch Roll podcast. We better get into some vegan face cream.
Oh, Christ.
You know, if you're... I think you have to be our age to really grasp the impact that that character had on like the psyche of a young 12-year-old. I mean, I don't know what it was like in the UK, but in the United States, you know, when you were a kid and you were our age, there's three channels and that's it. That's all you get to watch. And it was The Love Boat and Fantasy Island,
yeah,
and like
and
Emergency
Charlie's Angels, yeah,
and Charlie's Angels. And
yeah,
like that was it. And I mean, what was the viewership on Fantasy Island?
It was massive.
Like,
I mean,
fucking massive.
They did the pilot. It was immensely successful. I think for the first four seasons that Hervé did the show, I think it's roughly 78 to 82, roughly. It was by, I think, 80, 81, the number one TV show in the world. So in the UK, it was the same imprint. Australia, you know, everywhere. Hervé Tattoo was world famous. And, you know, what's interesting is the parallel with Peter now, you know. So Peter is the most famous dwarf on the world, on the biggest TV show in the world now. And so there's this meta thing that he's playing the most famous dwarf in the world on the biggest TV show then. And I think that's what drew him to the story. And I think that's what will hook, hopefully, the audience in. Mm-hmm. But the movie that we're giving them, I think, is quite different to what they're going to expect or to what they might perceive. They're probably going to think it's quite kitsch and funny and ha-ha.
And it's about ego and fame and, you know, sobriety and these heavy, you know, these
really heavy
things.
It's also about friendship, about how out of conflict
and
sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a, but that's right. This movie is about two desperately lonely people who somehow find each other and connect and are able to alleviate their loneliness. And I don't know, that was something I felt at the time, you know, and I knew how lonely Hervé was. And, I was not dissimilar to Danny Tate in some sense. I was struggling with, you know, coming out of a very bad period of booze and drugs. And I didn't...
You weren't that newly sober, though.
No, I wasn't.
Time.
You were about a year, weren't you? Yeah.
That's right. I was about a year, and obviously Danny is 30
month.
Days,
yeah.
month or so. Mm. Again, you know, in terms of the movie, we wanted to bring the audience into the intimate feelings of the experience. And, you know, there were three meetings with Hervé over a week. We made that into just one night, you know. Danny's 30 days sober rather than a year. You know, we just wanted to up the ante and increase the stakes so people could really feel
right.
what was going on.
And Jamie, what was it for you that attracted you to this project?
Just money, really.
Yeah,
I got paid a fortune.
Yeah,
paid
you're
more.
Only promoting like 20 movies right now.
No,
right?
I know.
It's going to be a big year for you.
It's a busy time. When I heard they're going to pay me more than Pete, I was like, okay,
yeah,
okay, why not?
I'm inappropriate as well.
Yeah. You know. I mean, did Pete get paid?
That's very meta with
no.
the
we paid him in Samuel.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah.
it's funny, you know, I guess relatively privileged, or definitely acutely aware of my privileged position at this time in my career, where I have an element of say over what I do, a bit of choice, which I'm sort of very grateful for. And you read a lot of varied projects, a lot of very different scripts and different worlds. And I love that about this, doing this for a living. I love the variety of it all. And occasionally when I'm sent something by my team or whatever, my agent will then send they'll send the sort of main bump of what it's about, like who's directing it, who's producing it, when they plan to shoot, what the budget is, whatever, in one email. And they did that with Hervé. And then I got a follow-up email directly afterwards from my agent saying, put this one at the top of the list, read this first. Which I always know means that it's a sign that she, you know, it's something that she's...
Right.
cares about. And you know, this has obviously been around for a long time. It's had previous incarnations, it's nearly been made, there's been other actors in Sasha's mind for to play Danny, and you know, so I was made aware of all that by my agent. And I read it, and I just was very caught up in it. I found it very emotional. It was mad. It was actually so
like,
mad.
This isn't
I mean?
Like
it was
the other script.
Mad, yeah, you know, it's really like just really wasn't. You know, I just felt like it was something totally.
Did you
unique?
Were you familiar with Fantasy Island? And was that like
a wee bit like where I come from, Belfast in Northern Ireland, and I guess we had like similar to you. We had three channels growing up, and if someone had said to me, who's Hervé Villechaize, I would have recognised that name. I would have known who he was. From Man with the Golden Gun, the Bond film he did as well, like Knick Knack, you know, I would have known him from that. We got Love Boat. I remember Love Boat being on at some ungodly hour and watching that a little bit. But it wasn't like massively in our sort of social consciousness growing up. But you know,
did you go back and watch old Fantasy Island reruns?
I did see some of it, yeah. It was.
How did they hold up?
Well, for a premise for a show, it's really kind of...
I mean, the pilot is one of the most genius things. The pilot was phenomenal. It was really dark and strange and original and unique. And then I think, you know, by season two or three, it had sort of...
Running out of ideas, really.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was not necessarily the brilliant show that it could have been. But it was for a while, and I think that... Hervé as Tattoo really became the sensation, because remember that show was originally a vehicle for Ricardo Montalban, who was a big star, and he'd danced with Sid Charisse and done many, you know, MGM musicals, and he was a really big deal and had been in a lot of Western films. And so they wanted to really find a vehicle for Ricardo, and then they thought, oh, let's have a henchman, a sidekick, and that became Hervé.
I understand this is the most difficult moment in your personal life, but we have a crew waiting, and this is not the first time you make them wait. Contrary to what you may think, I am your friend and I understand your pain. Although I hate the sin, I've been taught to love the sinner. So please listen to me very carefully. If you decide to leave now, your life will never be the same. And I promise you, you will regret it. So come, Tattoo. Let's welcome our guest.
Thank you for trying, Ricardo.
Perhaps there's another little man.
Ultimately, Tattoo became so popular that the scenes you see in the film with the kind of fan mail were pretty exactly what happened, that right. Suddenly Tattoo started getting 7 bags and Ricardo got 1. Mm-hmm. And so it became the Tattoo show. And I think it became so, I mean...
Well, that's when the demand started as well, to be paid same as Ricardo and all the sort of madness that ensued.
The madness. And I mean, I remember Hervé telling me a crazy story that's not in the film, that he was so famous that he couldn't go shopping at a supermarket. And one time, well, the last times he went shopping, he was shopping and this businessman came up to him and said, hey, my kids are like huge fans of Tattoo. I really want you to meet them. And he said, oh, thank you so much. I'll sign an autograph. He said, no, you've got to meet them. And Hervé said, well, I'm kind of shopping now. I mean, are they here? No, they're at my house. Will you come? And Hervé said, I can't. I've got to go somewhere. Anyway, the guy picked Hervé up and put him into the trunk of his car
and drove him
against his will to his house to meet children. And from then on, he said he always carried a gun. Because he was 3 foot 10.
But he always carried a knife anyway, right?
He carried a knife always, but from then, that was the moment he carried a gun.
Wow.
He was 3 foot 10. You could just grab him. You know, and so he was heavily armed because he was tired of being forced to do things like that.
Jesus.
And tired of being walking down the street in Paris and having its head kicked in, which really happened.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, but it's a push and pull, because on some level he wanted that and demanded it. Like the drive behind his ego, which is fueled by pain, of course, propelled him to arrive at such a place.
But of course, and this is the thing with fame, and I know Jamie's experienced a lot of the other side of the curtain, you know, and for those people I've spoken to, I don't know how you feel, Jamie, but it's quite hollow from what I've seen. In other words, there's no there. And I think that Hervé, as you say, had this very deep primal pain, like most human beings do, and he wanted something outside of himself to fill it up. And for a while it worked, you know, but at a certain point, you know, he says it, Peter says it, I think, very eloquently in the film, you know, at the end of the day, I realize I'm no different to anyone else addicted to a fantasy,
right.
The fantasy that something or someone will take away the pain of life. And
that
we
was
all
the
have
other,
that.
That was the other quote that I wrote down.
Well, that's good.
That really does capture it.
It captures, because you know? All of us, you know, we pursue these things, you know, I'm going to get, you know, I'm going to make $1 million, or I'm going to win an award, or I'm going to marry this amazing person, or I'm going to try, you know, and there's going to be this thing that's going to fix it. And I think, you know, Hervé's like, you know, one of the most salient examples of, you can have everything, but if what you're looking from everything, you know, is the wrong thing, you have nothing.
When
you know?
You're looking outside of yourself fill whatever hole.
And he was, and it was, the pain was too great. He had this opportunity. He wasn't really an actor. He was a performance artist. He was a brilliant painter. He kind of fell into this thing. And for a while, the fame really filled him up. And I think that's where he and Peter are so dramatically different, in that Peter really understands the emptiness of the world. And he really sort of protects himself from it. I think Hervé, in one sense, was so desperate to heal this kind of inner pain that he sort of filled up with as much as he could. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, there's no there, you know, and he realized that. And I think Danny helps him come to terms with that and make peace with his life before he ends it.
Right. I mean, intellectually, we all understand that on some level. that we're not going to find that sense of peace and purpose and fulfillment in anything outside ourselves. And yet I think we all still fall prey to the delusion that, like, well, maybe.
Exactly.
But if I, you know what I mean? Like,
of course.
It's an ongoing battle. And like you said, I mean, Jamie, you know, I can't imagine what life is like for you having to navigate the world being who you are. As somebody who can probably relate to what that's like more than, you know, most people on the world, like, how do you maintain your sense of self and groundedness? I mean, it's got to be mad.
A lot of it is doing methamphetamine.
You did a couple movies.
Which is incredible. I mean, he keeps it quiet.
He's pretty mellow, yeah.
He's sort of dealing now, so if anyone wants to call him.
I think.
Right. Medicaid heavily.
Do we have a number then? That I'm
it's 1-800-VEGAN.
My cell number is... To be honest with you, like, I almost am not conscious of it. It's not something that I am aware. I sometimes live in LA, but don't really live in LA. We live in the countryside, a couple of hours outside London. I see the first things I see in the morning are my beautiful little girls and my wife, and then some sheep and some cows, and our life is separate from whatever it is that people expect that comes with being in the public eye or whatever. I feel that was a decision that we made, that, you know, particularly because we have young kids and want to protect them from it. I don't want them to know what I do for a living until they really sort of have to, you know what I mean? And my feeling is that it's very isolated, I find, with recognition or fame or whatever. Within my life, it's isolated to moments where people know where you're going to be. If people know where you're going to be, you're fucked. But any other time, you're grand, because especially if you live where we live, because there's no one out there. There's no paparazzi. We've chosen to separate ourselves from that. But if you're at a premiere or you're at an event or whatever it is where people know you're going to be, then it can be uncomfortable. But that is so, that is, you're talking 5 days or nights a year.
Yeah.
And the rest of the time, it's not my consciousness.
But are you aware, Jamie, going through your life as you do, are you aware what it would, could you see how people could fall into?
Totally. And I always think you could make so much more. I mean, I'm not on social media. I think that's a great way to separate yourself from whatever it is, fame, recognition, whatever you want to call it. That's, in fact, that's the key way of staying out of it, is not to be on social media. There's so much more you can make of it, and you could choose to, you know, which I think Hervé did, you know, make the most out of. And listen, I think part of that is down to the fact of his physical size and the opportunities that come, especially then, but even so now, that there's less opportunities in this sort of world to make money and to continue the ride. And I think Hervé was acutely aware of that and made the most of that, whereas Pete has the opportunity to, you know, make so much more out of who he is, and he's the lead in the biggest TV show in, you know, the last, you know, certainly decade, and he chooses not to do that. He has a pretty anonymous life in Brooklyn, and very normal existence, and again isn't on social media, and that's something he's done to protect himself and his family. And so Pete and I, it's not the only reason we get on so well, but I think we both share that same thing, the same sort of approach to it. And it just has no, the idea of fame has so little interest to me. It's not,
do people most misunderstand about it?
I think the biggest thing is that people think you're going to be, I'm trying to get away from saying like actors are humans too, but like, but it's that thing of like,
you just said
you
it.
Are just people who do something different for a living. Mm-hmm. We just do something different to other people. Like it's still a job. And I think the onus and the attention and the amount that is given to people who are fans, the amount of fucking magazines and the amount of shite websites and the amount of social media stuff, it's just fueling this need for people to know
more.
So then it exasperates that idea that if you're famous, you're like this untouchable thing. You're like you're other. Like, oh, wow, they do. They're not just fucking,
they're on a yacht in South France.
Right, constantly.
I mean, but that's the thing. I think the social media thing is absolutely key. And that's why I think the film, you know, if it has some timeliness, a large part of it is because of this meditation on fame, because since Hervé lived in the past 25 years, particularly in the past 10 to 15, you know, the idea of the value of celebrity and the value of fame being sort of elevated to this kind of almost princely kind of otherworldly level of kind of achievement and importance. I mean, I find it really disturbing when young kids who I run into or whatever, what do you want to be when you grow up? I want to be famous. Like, you know, they think they can go on American Idol and, you know, people don't understand that it takes a ton of work. It takes years of work. They say it takes 20,000 hours of something to get good or to get excellent at any particular skill. And I think what's worrying is a lot of kids growing up with this incredible entitlement. And they're on Instagram, which to me is basically a big promotional campaign for either your business or to boast and say how incredibly happy you are. For me, the people who insist on how happy they are usually aren't. And you've got kids, young kids growing up, kind of comparing their insides with other people's outsides. And so I don't think, you know, there could be a better time to really speak to ultimately the hollowness and emptiness of something which is so ephemeral and meaningless. And people famous for being what? For being on a TV show? You know, to me, it's a very, in a strange way, strangely degraded time in culture where we've got to get back to just being real human beings and stop really, you know, selling ourselves out to these flimsy, false, inauthentic ideas that somehow, if we're famous and we have 14 million followers on YouTube, that, you know, that has meaning in the real world. It doesn't.
It's going to take some U-turn, though.
I'm saying I agree, and it's worrying. And I think we need to be discussing this stuff. We need to be telling kids, listen, fame is like it was for Hervé. You know, that Jamie and Peter's attitude toward it, exactly the right one, because it will devour you. It will swallow you. And if you give yourself over to it, there is nothing there except a whole bunch of, you know, suicidal depression. And, you know, it really is. But I find the kids growing up, as I say, comparing their insides to other people's outsides with no sense of what it means to actually work hard and achieve something over a long period of time, you know, they're in for a really rude awakening.
It's a confusing time because there are those outlier examples of people who do seem to suddenly, you know, become culturally relevant for very little reason.
Exactly.
And they're making all this money, and it's you know, as somebody who has kids, you have young kids. Mm-hmm. I got two daughters.
Me too.
As a parent, it's frightening.
Terrifying.
It's scary. I mean, I have a 12-year-old daughter. Lord knows what she's exposed to, but the reality is I do know that it is really hard for young people who are just emotionally developing, just beginning to feel who they are and trying to find their feet.
Can you imagine if when you were 14 years old that you could pull out a supercomputer out of your phone and see all the people that didn't invite you to the party having fun at the party at
it's
your
horrible.
Expense? You know,
dude,
like,
don't
imagine that on a young, impressionable brain and what that does to your sense of self.
Well, I think what we're seeing is the symptoms of that, which is an increasingly desperate and awful opioid crisis amongst middle-class families and their kids. And, you know, the degradation that we're seeing is as a result of those things, because, you know, we're teaching kids, rather than to feel good about themselves, to feel like shit, the online bullying that goes on. I mean, I'm just happy that we're able to have the discussion to at least shine a light on it, whether it makes a difference or not, who knows. But to be able to discuss these real things, you know, and to be able to have this film talk about fame in the way it
does. And even if you achieve it for the right reasons and you're grounded, like Jamie appears to be, I don't know you, but you seem like you have your shit together. Would imagine it's different. Like, one thing I would imagine it has to be incredibly challenging is every time you meet somebody, they're projecting some idea of you onto you.
Yeah.
And second to that, like, where, you know, what's the angle? What do they want? You know, you have to, like, what's everybody's agenda, right? You can't just take people at face value.
I think that the projection there, I think you touched on something that's exactly how I see it, is that anyone who meets me who doesn't know me, everyone who meets me who doesn't know me has a projection of what I am.
It's not even their fault.
No, and listen, we were all probably guilty of that a wee bit, like with people.
I did the same thing with Hervé when I met him.
Of course,
I projected onto him the ha-ha.
And it's something
joke.
We can all work on trying to not do. But I think for me, from the other side of it, I guess, is that like you're fucked the moment you live up to the projection. That's when you're fucked.
Or you start playing to it.
We all know. I know what the projection of me is. Like, and people, you know, I don't know.
What is it?
It's probably not something massively positive. I think people think I'm just going to be a fucking a tool, like a total.
But you know what's spanner. But can I say what's really interesting is because this whole film is about being judged. One of the themes is how we all prejudge and rush to judgment. You know, in a way, what I love about Peter and Jamie in the film is the audience will bring their preconceptions about whatever they think. And you're talking about two people who have, for large parts of their life probably, been judged on their looks. But, you know, it's superficial. Once you peel away the layers, once you actually try and interrogate what is the truth, who are these people? It's, as Jamie says, so different to what you imagine. And we also want to discuss that. The idea that, you know, you can't literally, that old maxim, you can't judge a book by its cover. You really don't know. It may seem a certain way, and your word seem was appropriate before, because the way things seem or appear, they're mostly not that way.
Yeah, that's a super interesting point. Because somebody who doesn't know anything can go into the movie and go, oh, it's the 50 Shades guy, it's the Game of Thrones guy, what is this going to be? And immediately they're in a place of prejudging something before they've seen a frame.
Yeah.
And I think Jamie and I...
And that's what the movie's about as well.
Exactly.
So we're back to the meta.
Which is exactly why I think Jamie and I recognize that it was a great opportunity because, look, for most people in my world, for example, being British, growing up in, you know, in England, you know, people actually know Jamie for The Fool, you know, which is one of the most incredible series for which he was nominated for a BAFTA. I mean, it's incredible performance,
that's what
right?
I know you from.
But a lot of you have to understand, a lot of people in mainstream America don't know that series necessarily. They don't necessarily watch The Fall on Netflix, or they don't know The Siege of Jadotville, or they don't know all the interesting projects that he's done over so many years. They just know him for this sort of massive commercial behemoth. So for us, there was the opportunity to completely defy those expectations and perceptions. And that's one of the things that so many people who don't know Jamie's work in depth have seen the film and said, oh my God, Dawn is so completely different to how I imagined. I mean, he's, you know, I'm the director, so I can say, but I think his performance in the film is pretty fucking incredible.
Yeah,
it defies what a lot of people think. And so that is absolutely something we were conscious of playing with. And I think you wanted to play with too, right? For certain parts of the audience.
No.
He didn't.
No.
Yeah.
That dude in The Fall was dark.
He was dark.
Was dark.
By the way, how close is that
human
to you? I want to know.
Far too close to talk about.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, yeah, pending charges.
No, what was interesting about that is, I mean, there's, it's confusing to watch that show because what he does is so reprehensible and incomprehensible, and yet there's a humanity to him.
You have some empathy,
you know,
right?
He seems like he's a pretty good dad. And
that's, you know, that was our point there, what we were trying to get across. It's not to compare famous actors to serial killers, but there is an element of like that thing of, you know, how you're perceived or portrayed or you know, they're humans too. I mean, it's that thing of like you can have the guy next door who holds down a really good job and who has a wife and two kids and be seemingly normal from the outside, and he's killing people at night. I mean, that's a thing. That's a real thing. You know, I don't know. I watched a lot of interviews with Ted Bundy and
Ted Bundy was a lot like that.
Dude,
right?
he's an impressive person to listen to. He's so eloquent, clearly so bright, charming. By the time just before he was killed, I mean, he wasn't hiding the craziness as well as that sort of, you know, other footage you see of him from before he was found out. But he, you know, for all intents and purposes, he's a normal dude. You know,
yeah. Apart from this slight psychopathic part,
on the surface, you know,
but he's compartmentalized. It's just this little area. You're right, exactly like any normal guy, apart from the fact that he has this additional he likes to kill people part.
Little asterisk,
just a little tiny little asterisk. Exactly. But that was great. With defying expectations, defying people's expectations or perceptions about Hervé, also about Danny Tate. Uh-huh. You know, all of these things. And the other thing was, as journalists, like particularly living in that world of British journalism of the 90s, it was so cynical. I'll give you an example. Mm. I was sent to interview a very and these journalists have this horrible reputation, much of which is entirely deserved. But what people don't understand is that often an editor or a newspaper has a particular agenda, and they'll send in a journalist, right, to basically do a shiv piece, which is, you know, like completely kill them, right? And that's not what the journalists themselves want, you know. And I was sent to interview an incredibly famous pop star, and I was told by my editor, this bloke is a wanker, and here are the reasons why. And I want you to basically skewer him and kill him. And I went to meet this guy, and I was like, okay, he's good looking. He's incredibly fucking brilliant. He's an unbelievable songwriter. I mean, and I loved him. And yet here I am and my task is to fucking attack this person. And it felt like shit. And I think that's
a tallest poppy syndrome, though, isn't it?
It's just horrible.
No one likes a tallest poppy.
And in Britain, that was particularly what it was. But, I can imagine a British journalist from a certain newspaper going, oh, Jamie Dornan, what a fucker, you know, and they'll come up with all, he's good looking, he's a movie star, fuck him, you know. But then there'll be the person who actually meets Jamie and goes, actually, he's pretty fucking cool. He's grounded. He doesn't take any of it or himself too seriously. You know, and then can you imagine you feel that, and then your job is still to kill that person. And again, to judge them and pigeonhole them in the same way that I was asked to do that with Hervé. Mm. So I wanted to also shine a light on the fact that not only are actors human, but also sometimes journalists in that situation really are in a really horribly treacherous, bankrupt moral place, because they're asked to do something that they don't believe in. And the only response to that, as I discovered at the end of the, as Danny Tate discovers at the end of the film, is to get the fuck out.
Yeah.
I couldn't stand the hate that these people had any longer. And the hate came from jealousy, and that came from being too afraid to have the courage of their own convictions and stand up and take a risk and risk failing and being embarrassed, which is part of success. You've got to fail, you know. And these guys, it was happy for them to sit behind the wall and snipe at other people. That was easy. Mm-hmm. And like Hervé says in the film, it's easy to sit on the sidelines and judge, isn't it, Junior? You know, and it is, because I've done that.
That was early mid-90s, right?
Yeah.
Imagine it now in the clickbait culture that we live. I mean, the pressure to, you know, create sensationalism out of these short, stupid articles is unprecedented.
And totally at the mercy of the editor. Like
right.
To jump in on that, like I've had many interviews in my career where you're almost tempted to ask them at the end to be nice, you know, like, just will you just be nice? Will you write someone nice? We've had a nice afternoon. Like, please don't turn this into a hatchet job. And that's exactly what's happened. I've left and gone, oh, that was really nice. I didn't embarrass myself. I don't think, you know, we talked, he seemed very, non-judgmental, and, you know, it all went well. And then it'll come out and it made me come across like a fucking prick.
Wanker. This is typical.
Wait till you
hear the edit that I'm going to do on this podcast.
Well, are we going to hear that bit?
Or what's the title?
Are you going to re-voice me?
It's just a short mini essay, Jamie Dornan cunt. That's what it's called. It's very short, and it's going to be a great piece. I can't wait.
It's all about the pickle and the...
By the way, you'll get more hits.
So what I'm getting from this is that we really are setting the world bang to rights. I think, are we all running for president? Is that what's going on?
We'd have a decent chance in this country.
We got fucking...
You're not American. None of you guys are. I'm the only person who could be.
Okay, well, we'll be on your team.
We'll support you. Can we be on the card or anything?
Yeah, we want to be on the card.
I might move to Ireland, actually.
There we go.
I love Ireland.
There we go.
Before we end, do you want to, like, have anything
We're ending
to do
already? Who said that? Why are you making that in
the That's a wrap.
Because I know before you end, that could be 30 minutes before we end. I just want to talk about you, Rich.
This is not about me.
I'd love to know because you're...
I don't want to talk about Rich. Do we not talk about him?
But he's amazing,
too. We talk all the time.
Okay, I know. I just want to see, is there some sort of...
I want to talk about the movie.
Okay, talk about the movie.
And you. I want to know more about... I want to talk about the the decision to go with HBO, but like walk us through the experience, you know, not the movie, but your own personal experience of what it was like, you know, where you were in your life when you were sent off to, you know, cover this guy. And the, and really the emotional impact that he had on you.
Literally,
that,
Jamie literally just fell asleep as he heard the question. He's literally closed. He's like, he's got a blanket. It's like, fucking more of this bollocks. Okay, no, look, I was newly sober. I was, you know, in a mess. I was a mess. I was a young 23-year-old kid. I'd got into lots of trouble with different things. I'd ended in a really bad situation in New York when I was 23. I was sort of, my cousin flew to New York, brought me home, set me down and said, you are going off the rails. You got to calm yourself down. And luckily, I was very fortunate. And I have to credit my mum, Millie Chavazi, who was astonishingly like the sort of lioness fighting for her deranged cub. You know, she made sure that I, you know, I had to go and get some fucking help.
Sorry, have I been saying your surname wrong the whole time?
No. What was the surname?
You just said Gervasi.
Yeah, well, you can, anyway. Oh, I said Gervasi, shit. Gervasi, it's fine.
You've been saying Gervasi?
I said Gervasi, yeah.
I've been calling him Jeremy all day, so anyway. But anyway, so I was really in that thing, and I really always wanted to be a writer, and I was very fortunate in that I called up Punch magazine, which was a satirical magazine, quite famous, had been going for about 200 years, and I managed to get through to the deputy editor, an incredible guy called Sean McCauley, and I called up Sean and pitched him an idea, and he said yes, and thus began my journalistic career. And Sean went over to the Mail on Sunday and kind of became my mentor and was incredible, gave me lots of jobs, and he was part of the decision-making process actually to send me to LA to meet Hervé. And I remember coming back after that and saying to Sean, look, man, we've got to get the fuck out of this racket. This is just terrible. And so, you know, within not too long, Sean and I both moved to Los Angeles to kind of work together and try our hand at screenwriting. And Sean obviously co-wrote the story with me on this and was a big part of
it. And he wrote the Eddie movie,
yes, he wrote the brilliant Eddie the Eagle, which is phenomenally hilarious and fun.
But tell that one story that you told me about being at Punch where you took out an ad.
Yeah,
to hire,
yeah.
You know
what happened
about,
was,
right?
there was a notion around the office of, like, when you
do
see,
you know,
these Bond
story?
Films.
No, I don't think so.
You see these Bond films, and it's like, you know, there's a Caribbean headquarters, and there's like 400 kind of, you know, like nimble little assistants in yellow jumpsuits with clipboards, and they're all trying to, you know, they've all got these nuclear weapons that are going to kill the world. And so the concept was, do an article putting the real ads. So, you know, Caribbean headquarters seeking disciplined kind of assistance for a nuclear-based program. Absolute loyalty a must. And so we actually placed ads, Punch placed ads.
Must be
and the letters
living,
that
living
we got back. Well, I was discharged unceremoniously from the army 4 years ago, but I have a really disciplined. And so basically we put in all the plots of the fucking Bond movies, like Goldfinger, everything.
Oh,
you know, we are located at Antigua. You know, I mean, and people wrote in and did not fucking get it and wanted to interview. And there were literally things, clues that were so obvious, like, if you do not fear the end of the world and would consider a long-term future in space, you know, like fucking Moonraker, like, it was madness, and people fucking loved it. They wrote in, and so really the Punch magazine then published all these different letters, and it was just fucking brilliant.
Like, I mean, the cover letters that people wrote in.
Yeah, wrote in. And they were serious, and, you know,
surely
they wanted
blanked
to do
out the
and,
name,
and they showed their references, and they, you know, although in combat I was, you know, unfortunately blamed for killing 11 people in a friendly fire incident,
right.
I still have incredible skills with weapons, and, you know, because there were certain ones asking for you, are you able to drive a tank, and could you submersibles, do you have, you know, it's like people saying hi.
But Punch was like legendary for its snark, right?
Yeah,
it was sort of a predecessor to Spy magazine.
It was sort of similar. It was like the British version of Spy, which obviously proliferated particularly in the 70s and 80s in the States. But it was very funny, and it was always just silly, you know, and it was basically a ridiculous idea, and you would find people to take it seriously, such as the Bond thing.
Right.
So, you know, there was always that element. And I have to say, that spirit of snark really was the thing that began the Hervé article, because we were sitting in the office of Associated Newspapers, which is, as it appears in the film, these giant floors of open desks and hundreds of reporters.
Miserable.
These were in the days where, you know, there was money in journalism. And I remember being, you know, oh, we've got this brilliant violinist, Sarah Chang. We're going to put you on a first-class flight to Florence. You're going to meet her, interview her, and then you're going on a river tour. You know, I mean, they spent fortunes right. on these stories and these interviews. And so we were sitting around in the office, and above there were banks of televisions. And at that point, there was really one cable channel called Super Channel, which was the worst channel. Right? It was actually one channel. And they were rerunning Fantasy Island. I remember sitting around with Sean and some of the other editors, and we were like, we saw Hervé go, you know, come on, and it was a ridiculous scene with Ricardo Montalban. And I said, where the fuck is he? I got to find him, because I was on my way out to LA. And what was really unusual about it was we managed to get to Hervé, but we had to go through three people. We went through a sort of drunk manager and a former assistant and then a publicist, and it all led to his personal publicist, Kathy. And we were like, oh, great, we're going to do this interview, you know. And then Hervé requested samples of my work. He would not agree to the interview until he had read some interviews I'd done. So I was like, what is this Howard Hughes routine? Like, the more absurd it was, the more intriguing he became, because we all thought, he should be so lucky, you know, tattoo, that someone even cares 10 years later to do something on him. And so that was really the first clue that something about this situation might turn out to be a little bit unusual. Mm. And so that's how it began, and eventually ended with this, with me meeting Hervé. And again, what I thought it was going to be, what I imagined when I saw him again on the TV, and the story and the film that we have 25 years later is so wildly different to I could never have conceived of what's happened.
How deep into it were you with him before you realized what was actually going on, that he was, in fact, giving you this last will and testament?
I really didn't know over the three meetings. I knew that he had this tremendous emotional need to spill his guts and to tell his life story and to talk about how he emotionally felt in it, you know, about things that had happened in his life. I knew there was something wrong. I mean, when he came up to me the first time and he was holding the knife, I could smell the medication. I mean, he was not well. So I knew he was not well. I knew he was sort of desperate. I knew he was also the most fascinating person I'd ever met, because he would veer between making a really clever, urbane sort of joke to sort of throwing a knife to me. And it was just like this, it was like being in a Fellini movie. I knew something was going on. My intuition obviously told me. I mean, look, when a guy pulls a knife on you saying that, do you want the real story? Of course, just as a journalist, you're going to be like, okay, what is it? So I didn't quite know. So over our three meetings, it just became increasingly clear that he was trying to somehow just make peace with whatever it was and just kind of tell someone. It was like a confessional.
So what kept you going? Was self-belief? Determination? Or was it just pure desperation? I mean, you had nothing to lose, nothing to go back to.
No, it was God. God is the one that kept me going.
You seriously believe in God?
Yes, and I know he will never let me down.
Well, some might say he already did.
Yes, he make me this way, sure. But I know he offer fame as one of his little compensations. I know it.
How could you possibly know that?
Because I pray for a miracle. And it happened.
You know, I just felt I was a priest at a certain point. He just kept going and going and going. And it was, just, of course, fascinating just to listen to the story. It really only made sense a week later. I returned home to London, and I was in my flat, and I remember the afternoon vividly. It was about 5:30, 6 o'clock in the afternoon on Sunday, the September the 4th, 1993. I was in my flat in South London, and my roommate, Mary, was making us a sort of an early dinner. And I was listening to these 12 hours of tapes going, how the fuck am I going to do a funny 500? I was like, there's no way this is going to work. And the phone rang, and I picked it up, and it was Kathy Self, you know, who was Hervé's real girlfriend, who said that Hervé...
That's who Mireille Enos plays
her in the movie. Yeah. Kathy called to say that, you know, Hervé had killed himself just a few hours before, 4 or 5 hours before. And I immediately actually started to cry because it clicked. And I started listening back to the tapes and I realized, okay, so he knew he was going to do this. And for some reason, he just grabbed this random journalist and just told him everything in almost the desperate hope that, you know, this story would be recorded. And so I walked into the newspaper, as it happens in the film, with this, you know, much bigger piece, completely different. And the editor said to me, she said, look, this is a great bit of journalism, but, you know, we have 6 million middle-class readers on a Sunday morning and they're going to choke on their chocolate croissant. This is too dark. It's too morbid. It's not what I want. I want a funny piece. And I was like, well, this isn't funny. And she said, I know. so I said, look, we'll take it somewhere else. you can't do that. We flew you out there. We own the photographs. We want you to rewrite it. And I was like, forget it. And so someone came in and rewrote it. And it just became a trivialized, sort of much more truncated version because, you know, we were pushing for front cover. It's a world exclusive. Like, even at that time, Hervé was fucking famous around the world. When I was with him in LA, people would shout out of cars, the plane. We'd be walking down, people ask for autographs all the time. So despite the fact that he hadn't been on the show for 10 years, Tattoo had made such a massive imprint on the culture, particularly here in the States, that wherever we went, we were kind of, there was a lot of activity and people wanting to meet him and give him a hug and say hi and obviously do his catchphrase. So we felt it was front cover, and they were like, no, it's not. I remember one of the editors saying, "What? Look, what's he done lately? An ad for a mobile phone and some Dunkin' Donuts commercials? I mean, come on, really? You know?" And that was the attitude. They didn't have the bandwidth to understand what had happened. They couldn't. It was a world that could not allow for someone to have an unexpected human experience and express it just, and that's why I felt like I was choking. I had to get the fuck out of that world because it was so narrow and cynical and kind of small in its mentality that I just couldn't do it. And I looked around the office, I remember, before I sort of quit, looking around the office and seeing all these guys who, you know, had been there for 40 years and probably had the same feelings I did, you know, at that time. And they hadn't acted on them. And there they were, sort of broken men, you know, like trying to, you know, call designers about what their favorite wallpaper for autumn was in wanting to kill themselves. Right. You know, I just thought, fuck it, man. I can't do it. Fuck it. I'll, and I got out.
Yeah. So it's this, the film is like this polemic on fame, on celebrity, on ego, but it's also a referendum on the press in a certain respect, I guess.
I don't know. From my point of view, I don't know how you feel about that, Jimmy, but it certainly wasn't an intention. I think it was really, for me, a look at that particular time in that particular culture. And I don't, because I haven't worked at a newspaper anywhere for many years. I mean, the last piece I think I wrote was for Financial Times 5 years ago. It was the last bit of a journalism I did. So I don't really know the world, but I do know that the world at that time was really quite, you know, was awful, to me at least. Other people, I guess you get used to it. But I mean, you, Jamie, have been on the other side, as you said. You know, you think you have a great interview with someone and then someone just like, you know, does a hatchet job on you. So it still goes on. It's just, I just couldn't live with myself because I was being asked to, you know, attack people that I respected. And that is not a great place to be if you want to make your living that way.
Jamie, it had to be weird doing this movie knowing that you're playing some version of Sasha. Did you ever, like, as a director, say, no, it's got to be like this? And you're like, no, the character would not do that. Like, did you guys ever go to loggerheads over how to play the character?
I mean,
well, the character had become Danny Tate.
You were able to distance yourself.
Well, I made it clear to Jamie when we first met, I was like, listen, man, this has to become your own.
Yeah.
Because I just got to direct a film. I can't be like, oh, this is what, you know, I 25 years ago would have done that. That's just a waste of time. So Jamie said, look, I'm going to do it as me. I'm going to do it in my Irish accent, and I'm going to make it as much me as you, sort of.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, I was like, great. So there wasn't really that ever a conflict.
We had I think we pushed each other.
We pushed each other,
In quite monumentous ways at times.
We did, but not about that.
Not about that, though. Yeah. About just you touching me.
I mean, I still say it was not inappropriate.
This story means so much to Sasha, and you know, through time, not very much time at all, really meant so much to Peter and I as well. And emotions were high a lot of the time, and we're a lot of what we're dramatizing is very high stakes stuff and very emotional stuff, and that carries through to, you know, the actual doing of, you know, it becomes something in itself that is very emotional, and the lines become blurred, and
there were
and
really,
if you get the what you think's a wrong note at the wrong time, and I mean, Sasha and I love each other dearly. You're the closest I've ever come to punching a director.
Yeah.
I would say.
And I'm probably the closest I ever came to punching an actor.
Yeah.
I mean, it was very intense, but it was intense because of several things, because of the time pressure we were under. Because also, I felt like, and this is a fair thing, Jamie, like, I would push Jamie beyond where he wanted to go. But when I did that, which I didn't do all the time, but maybe on two or three occasions when we were shooting, you know, I said, you've just got to trust me, Jamie. You need to go farther. And it was his discomfort and his, you know, whatever he was going through that actually fed into the performance. This is a guy who's on edge, who's not comfortable, who's out of his comfort zone, who's terrified, who's angry. And so what we did was created that emotional environment.
basically, what he's saying is he was right.
I think that's right.
Well, we're getting
but come
here,
on,
yeah.
when you look at the film, no, Jamie, this is serious. When you look at the film now and you think about all the stuff, pretty much everything we did, even the two or three times where I push you too far, are in the film.
Potentially, yeah. I haven't seen the last final cut.
Well, so I mean, it's not about right or wrong, but he was right also because he was like, how do I deal with this fucking director? It's his, you know. So I think that, but out of that came something real.
I mean,
you know?
We'll never work.
Right. Well, that relate, he could just project that emotional state onto Peter on screen.
Well, I mean, Peter, we had also similar.
Well, yeah, exactly.
You know, there was a lot, and also there was a lot between the two of them, you know.
And it was very claustrophobic at times. We were literally inside a fucking limo, you know, like a shell of a limo, you know, like a set limo set that
at
was
Ealing
no bigger
Studios,
than a real.
And we were shooting through the weekend because we had no time, and at the pressure of making the film absolutely informed the atmosphere, and of course the performances. But the whole movie is about pressure. It's about this pressure that builds. So it worked for the film, but going through
you definitely get the sense from you, Jamie, you're like, get me out of this limo.
Which is exactly what you want. Yeah.
And also, he said to me at times, get me out of this film. Is it too late to fucking cast someone else? So, I had Andrew Garfield on standby.
Of course. He was in the boot. He was in the trunk.
Ready to step in.
We got to wrap it up. You guys got to get on the road to some other more important interview.
No.
I could talk to you guys for hours
this
about
is it,
this. There's
man.
So many other things I wanted to
but
get
just,
into with
you.
You
should
but,
finish up. Was there any final points you wanted to make?
Well, are you queuing me up to say nice things about the movie?
No. I'm queuing up to make final points.
No.
I've got to use the toilet.
I did love the movie. It was emotional for me. I think you did a beautiful job. And like I said, as somebody who has, you know, from arm's length, been on, you know, sort of, in a sidecar on this journey, witnessing it from afar, I'm super proud of you for making this movie, for fulfilling your vision. On some level, it perfectly bookends Anvil, because Anvil is about the quest to achieve some level of fame and stardom and success. And this serves as a sort of reminder, counterpoint to what can happen if you're not paying attention to your insides and you're not grounded and you don't have a healthy relationship with who you are and why you're doing what you're doing. And I thought it was beautifully executed. Jamie, you were amazing in the movie. Nice. And
really incredible. No, yeah, I mean, I was blown away. You know what was amazing for me, just having a front row seat to this, was sometimes just watching the monitor and seeing what Jamie and Peter were doing and go, fuck, man. They're you know, it was so much better than I had hoped it was going to be. And it was just a privilege to be to witness it, as well as birth it, you know, and all that stuff.
Christ.
Okay, but on your subject of wanting to
we have to
pay attention to the insides, can I use the fucking loo now?
Yeah, you can. The movie premieres on HBO everywhere worldwide on October 20th, right?
And from there, yeah.
Yeah, everybody check it out. I saw the billboard on Sunset. Looks amazing.
It's mega.
Beautiful as always, Jamie.
Billboard.
Yeah, thanks for doing this, you guys.
Thanks, Rich. We love you, man.
All right, you guys.
Thanks, buddy.
Peace.
Cheers.
My mic wasn't on.
I told you, right? I told you that would be a fun ride. That was so cool. What a treat. Hope you guys enjoyed it. Smartly, neither of these dudes is on social media, so you can't hit them up there. But do them a solid and just make sure to tune into the movie when it premieres on HBO on October 20th. My Dinner with Hervé. I loved it. I think you guys will too. Hey, listen, if you're looking for some additional nutritional guidance, you know you should eat better, but you just don't know how to do it. You don't like cookbooks. You're not great in the kitchen. This is what our Plant Power Meal Planner is all about. Go to meals.richroll.com, and there you will find thousands of plant-based recipes, literally thousands, all super customized based on your personal preferences that you input when you sign up. It integrates with unlimited grocery lists and even grocery delivery in most US cities. So when you decide on the recipes you like, all the materials, all the foods that you need to prepare those dishes magically appears at your doorstep. We have incredible customer support 7 days a week from experts who know what they're talking about. And all of this is available for just $1.90 a week when you sign up for a year. So again, go to meals.richroll.com or click on Meal Planner on the top menu on my website, richroll.com. If you would like to support the work that we do here on the show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or on whatever platform you enjoy this content. What else can you do? You can share it with your friends and on social media. You can leave a review. You can subscribe to my YouTube channel. But really, just tell a friend, spread the word. And I appreciate that very much. I want to thank everybody who helped put on the show today. Jason Camiolo for audio engineering, production, show notes, interstitial music. I want to thank Blake Curtis and Margot Lubin for graphics, theme music by Analemma. And I want to thank Jamie's team for being very helpful and making him available to do this podcast here today. And of course, much love to Sasha. I love you. Thanks for the love, you guys. See you back here next week with the great Scott Harrison, founder of Charity Water. He's going to talk about his work and his new book. It's called Thirst. It just made the New York Times bestseller list. It's an amazing conversation. Look forward to sharing that with you. Until then, peace plants. Namaste.